Hello, hello, and welcome, welcome to another episode of Conversations with Remarkable Women. I'm Nick Devlin, and I'm a co-founder of a business called Remarkable Women with Danielle McLeod. And for those of you who don't know our story, we started the company over 3 years ago now. We're into our fourth year. Why? Because we saw women who really, really wanted to make a huge difference in the world and have a big impact, really struggling with this question around what will be the cost, this perceived cost of my relationship, cost of my health, cost in terms of maybe job security, and really, really trying to grapple with how can I show up in the world and not have this cost. And what we also saw as well was women who were really struggling to not get in their own way. And one of the things that we have seen consistently, is this idea that women have, which is, it's just me, it's just me. And so one of the amazing things around Conversations with Remarkable Women is we get to share stories and we get to see actually the power of women when they share and they come together. So for those of you who are new to the podcast, welcome. Often what you will see is we invite women from the community to come and speak to us. And equally, we often invite other remarkable women to come and share. And today I am beyond delighted to introduce you to an outstanding woman called Miriam. So welcome, Miriam.
Hi, Nick.
Thank you so much for doing this, Miriam. I'm going to give everybody who is either going to be watching this or listening to this a heads up to say this is definitely one of those podcasts that you need to bring your tissues for. I just said to Miriam before we came on this call, I've got mine ready. And I actually had a little bit of a cry with her before we came on. So apologies in advance if this is one of those that really moves people, because it is a really powerful story, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd like to start here, Miriam. One of the things that we often talk about in Remarkable Women is how we buy into this idea that there is there's almost this ideal life that we can create. Maybe not necessarily perfect, but you know, if we can only maneuver it and control it, we can create this life for ourselves where everything is locked down, everybody is safe, we know where we're going. And then it's almost like there is what we might call a plot twist. You get it one day and all of a sudden something happens and your life is changed forever. And so you had that experience, right? So that's what we're probably going to dive into today. I just want to say up front, I'm minded that there are some sensitivities around this story. So maybe if you'd like just to share with us about a little bit around that, just as a context for what we might go on to discuss, that would be great.
Yeah, certainly. So throughout the story, I'm not going to be kind of mentioning names or anything like that. That's probably not needed for us to get to the story in full, and it won't detract from the points that we're making. The reason being is there's a lot of people involved in this. There's a lot of sensitivities. There's a lot of hurt, upset, grief, etc. still going on and will be doing for a long time to come. So we just want to make sure that this is focused kind of on my story from the event that happened and how kind of I came through it, etc. Or I'm still coming through it. But as I say, there'll be certain details that we will be omitting from this session, purely from a sensitivity element and to make sure we protect and keep people safe.
Thank you for sharing that, Miriam. I think that's super important. And you've already intimated, I think one of the things that's super powerful about stories is it doesn't just happen to us. Mm-hmm. There is a sense of almost like a ripple effect, a cobweb effect of lots of other people that we may know and equally we may not know. So thank you so much for just helping us navigate that. So Let's start here then. Let's start here. What was your life like before your plot twist?
Well, it's really funny how you say, Nick, kind of, we aspire for this certain kind of life of everything in its place, and it's a place for everything. And I'd probably say that actually, I'd kind of finally got to the point where I thought, I've arrived. I'm kind of here. A very loving partner, a son doing well, a home together, a life together. I had got to a place in my work where I'd kind of finally found a little niche of mine. I really enjoyed it. Everything was going okay, as okay as it could be. And just before the start of the year, we had, as a family, we had had some family deaths through old age. So my grandma and my uncle had passed away just before, kind of between September and Christmas. So we'd kind of had to navigate a bit of that, because from my son and my nephew's perspective, these were really close relatives, and it was their first time kind of dealing with death in a way that they really understood it, and going to a funeral for the first time and things like that. But we had our little close-knit family, and we all got through it together.
I love how even that, you know, there's such, one of the things that you and I have talked about before is one of my passions is to really start to change the dialogue, the conversation around death. And it's interesting, yeah, isn't it? As you say there, you know, when my own experience, for example, you know, with losing somebody when I was young, is we're not prepared for it. It's almost like we don't know how to talk about it. And it's only when something actually happens that you're then in the conversation.
Yeah, definitely. So it was making sure that the three boys, our three cubs, as we call them, just knew it was okay, that, you know, it's going to be really sad. The adults around you, so the adults who you look up to, me, you know, my mum and dad, the grandparents, and my sister, and my partner, and Stanley's uncle, and stuff, we're all going to be really sad. You're going to see us all be really vulnerable now. You're going to see us cry, get angry, get upset, get frustrated, but you can come through that with us as well. So it's okay for you to cry and get frustrated and get upset. And even really recently, my youngest nephew, he still, every now and again, has a moment where it floods back over him, and we just allow him that space and that time, and that it is, we're all navigating it together. There's no one who is a pro, thank goodness. No one should ever be a pro when it comes to grief. So yeah, it's one that was really awful that things happened so quickly and so together, but it really kind of put us all as a family into what me and you talk about now regularly, of that kind of masterclass of how do we now get these three boys used to death and used to grief, and knowing that what grief is all about, and that grief is not a quick fix. You've just got to kind of go through the motions.
Yeah, and so, I love even that reminder that the only thing that's ever guaranteed, ever, in all of our lives, a consistent thing in all of our lives, is indeed death. Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it, this idea, I guess, that we're going to experience it in somebody else before our own. And what I really love about your story already, Miriam, is the permissions that you gave the three cubs to know that whatever they were feeling, however it shows up, that's okay.
Yeah, definitely. And it did, it showed up in many weird and wonderful ways with them. So Stanley, my son, still has...
How old is Stanley, Miriam?
Stanley is 15. Stanley was 15 in May. So he was 14 when this was all happening, but he still has... You know the pamphlets that you get at a funeral? Both of those are up on his shelf, of my grandma and my uncle, and they're just there. And I keep saying to him, do you want to swap? Nope. The fact, all right, well, you know what, if you want to keep them there for the next 5 years, you keep them there for the next 5 years. I think people look at those type of things and go, oh, well, that's just a reminder of the funeral. Well, maybe it is, but maybe that's a good thing, because maybe Stanley needs those kind of reminders to know that number one, how loved he was and how much he loved someone else as well.
What's so beautiful, Miriam, I'm not sure that you'll be able to see this, and certainly people who are listening won't know this, is as you've been speaking about those two people that have passed, the most amazing sunlight is beaming, is beaming through the window, literally onto Miriam's face. So whatever your beliefs, religious, spiritual or otherwise, it's a really beautiful moment, actually, just to honour that as you've been sharing about those two loved ones, it's incredible actually to see it on the screen, how beautiful that sun is on, crazy, particularly given the time of year that we're in, right?
Exactly.
In the middle of winter and pure sun is, sunbeam is, shooting onto Miriam's face. That is just beautiful, beautiful. And so you mentioned there, Miriam, a phrase that a term that you and I have talked about a lot, this idea of masterclasses. So just in case there are people listening who haven't heard this, I'll just say a little bit more about this. So a masterclass is when I explain it, many of you will know, That's what I've been experiencing. A masterclass is something that comes to you as an experience that probably never in your worst nightmare would you ever choose. There's an intensity inside a masterclass because you're almost thrown into it. And it can feel often as if, as I say, something that you wouldn't want, you wouldn't choose. And yet if we can look to explore what is happening to us from a place of, you know what, why? What can I learn from this? What are my insights? And actually, if I just walk into this as open-hearted as I possibly can, of course, with vulnerability and include some courage, what might I be able to teach to others as a result of this, as a result of this experience? So let's just dive into your masterclass then, Miriam. So could you share with us, you've already talked to us about you had some experience of recent experience actually of death and bereavement. Could you walk us through now what the start of your masterclass was?
Yeah, absolutely. So literally at the start of the year, I got a phone call engraved in my psyche and in my brain for the rest of time, and that was to let me know that a colleague of mine who I managed had committed suicide. They had been off work for a few weeks poorly, and they then made the decision to take their own life, and that phone call was the start then of a masterclass that we've basically been going throughout with it, I'd say, well, the whole year. You really can't ever prepare yourself. You'll never be able to prepare yourself for, number one, that type of phone call, number two, the aftermath of what comes after, and it really, really floored me. So I'd probably say up until probably January, a lot of things have happened in my life, and we've all got stories and stuff, but I was kind of overcome them and kind of tried to remain Miriam and not lose Miriam throughout those. In this masterclass since January, Miriam has definitely been lost at times and needed to absolutely find her way back. So there was the initial impacts, obviously, of the suicide, which was just absolutely devastating.
Can I just take you back? Can you remember the experience of the phone call?
Yeah. I can remember the first call I missed because I'd actually just put my phone down to go to bed, and then I saw it light up and I looked and I thought, I saw the name and I saw the time. And straight, we all talk about that kind of gut feeling, spidey sense, and something started. I felt that this is not good. Whatever this call is about to tell me, it's not good.
And how did you feel that? Can you explain a little bit about?
I think it was just the time. This person had never contacted me before. It was later on at night. I'd actually tried to call my colleague that day and they hadn't answered. It had gone to voicemail, which was really unusual because my dear, dear, dear colleague and friend was always quite, always on time, always structured, always everything had a box and everything had a place for everything. So if you'd arranged to have a catch up, have a something, any form of meeting at work or something, they were there all the time, present and ready and correct. So it was just a car. It was just this really dark feeling, just a really pit of your stomach. I feel a little bit sick, and I already think I know to some degree what's about to be said. I've just got that feeling. It was, as I say, I can't really put it into words. It was just there.
I love how you've shared that, though, because one of the things we often talk about from the perspective of women, and we speak from women as women, is this inner knowing that women often have. Sometimes, as you're speaking about now, it can be a sense of foreboding. Sometimes it can be, you know, clarity or a wisdom, but just this deep intuition or knowing. Mm. And one of the things that we really work on with women is how do we tune into that so we get to listen to it more? Because it's powerful, right? And so it's incredible to just know that just by being able to look at a phone, you're able to tap into something that says, something significant is about to happen.
Yeah. And I think, Nick, I think as women, I do think throughout life, we're kind of told to not believe our gut, to kind of suppress that inner emotion and that inner sense of somehow predicting sometimes the future. So yeah, I think that is really powerful, and I think it's something I will definitely throughout this masterclass. I know when my spidey sensor goes. I know now when my gut goes to follow that instinct, to absolutely follow it, because it definitely came up quite a lot and quite often throughout that masterclass. Did this kind of gut feeling, this sense of everything's going to be okay, or a sense of we're entering uncharted waters here, so it's about to get quite choppy. So yeah, that definitely kept coming up.
And so with that sense, something significant is likely to happen or is going to happen, what next?
So from that point, I for the first time ever had to let my team at work obviously know what had happened.
Was the call to let you know?
The call was to let me know this is what's happened. I then needed to the next day start to make calls out to say this is what's happened.
And how was that night for you, Miriam, from taking a phone call to making calls? Let's not skip over that bit.
Yeah, so Stanley actually woke up because he heard my devastation in the news. Mark shot out of bed as well, and I would just sat on the steps. So they both were kind of, what the heck's going on? What's happening? I didn't speak to Stan at that moment in time specifically about what happened, but I'm sure we'll get to that because that was another part of the masterclass I had to overcome when we're talking about how you let children know certain bits of information. That night was, I want to say a blur, but I know it's not a blur. It didn't feel like I was me. It didn't feel like I was now in this situation. I couldn't have been. It just doesn't happen. It's people don't commit suicide. People have more to live for. Apologies.
Sorry, don't worry.
It's it just went by in about no sleep, no nothing. I'd say in a bit of a daze panic of, I think Miriam is a natural fixer. How the heck do I fix this? And there was no answers.
Which is typical of a masterclass, because a masterclass will push you into a place, exactly as you said before, unknown, uncertainty. Yeah. I have never been in this place before. And the power of the masterclass is almost you go into a cave thinking, what next?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'd probably say I probably lived in that cave for about 6 months after the initial passing of my colleague. So obviously the next kind of week or so was just, I can remember at one point, Mark actually said, well done to me.
That's your husband, right, Mark?
Yeah, my partner, yeah. After 5 days, because I actually got a shower, because it was absolute... I think I went into a bit of a zombie-like state. It was, I'm here, but I'm absolutely not here. I'm tapped out. I am somewhere else. Whilst trying to figure out how I support my team, because they
were
absolutely...
How many are on your team, Miriam?
We are only a little tiny small team. So I had, at the time, there was my boss, me, and there were four colleagues who had worked with the individual. And a couple of those were extremely close. They'd worked together for a long, long, long time. So it was, how do I balance what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking and my own grief and navigating this whilst putting on the brave face and putting my arms around everybody else and telling them it'll be okay whilst not actually really believing it'll be okay because I don't know if it'll be okay. And on top of all that, how the heck do you deal with this immense grief of someone, not only who is your friend, close colleague, everything, who you spoke to, you know, throughout the, you know, you spoke to on a regular basis, you'd emailed 2 weeks before, suddenly just gone. That's it. There's no final talk. There's no final words to say. There's no goodbye. And ultimately, the whole massive, huge question that has gone on throughout all of this is why? Why?
It's interesting, even as you say that word, why, there's a haunting. There's like an ache, a search, a despair, a why. And I think that's one of the things which is particularly tricky for people navigating suicide in particular, because for so many people, myself included, when we had the experience of it as well, is you lean into the idea that you may never know why. And that can be really tricky, because I think though you may not understand some of the other aspects of death, particularly I think with a suicide, that why, what did I miss? What could I have known? Why is, can really burn.
Absolutely. And that is something that has kept me awake for many, 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 many nights. Anybody who, what was close to them, family, loved ones, partners, friends, anything. I mean, I was asking the questions why they must be asking it triply more times than even myself, and thinking and feeling their grief and what they must be going through. And again, how do you fix it? We fix things. That's what we do. We're remarkable women. We go and fix everybody. And sometimes it's not about fixing, it's about just understanding and what you then do from that understanding. It still is. I don't think I'll ever not ask myself that question. I might be, I think I can now definitely deal with it differently when that question pops in and my crazy lady, which we all talk about, starts to kick in. I now have methods and things that can certainly support me and help me with that. But do I think that question will ever go away? No. I think with suicide it will always be there. It's just getting comfortable with not knowing the why.
I love that. Getting comfortable with not knowing the why.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Because as you say, the crazy lady, the voice in our head, which continually will have a narrative about whatever is going on in our life, could drive you wild, right? With an endless search. And who knows if you ever find the answer. Yeah. And so I'm intrigued then. So in that period of the week, what I'm hearing is this impossible task. Task doesn't really seem to fit, but let's go with that. This impossible task that you were taking on of how do I process this loss, this unexpected mm-hmm. news, whilst also support other people and cognizant of, as you said earlier, a young person in your own home watching his mum do that processing. That's quite something to take on.
It was. Still is. So...
And let me just say this, Miriam, I really love your honesty there around it took somebody else to say to you, it's time to get showered.
Yeah.
It's almost like you go to the, you know, literally survival. Nothing else matters.
No. And it also got to the point, I think, I definitely started to shut off. I definitely started to shut off from... So as much as asking the question why, there was then the what have I done? Mm-hmm. What did I do? Mm-hmm. Every conversation you've ever had, every text, email, phone call, video, every exchange you've ever had with that person, you go back and start to go, right, what did I miss? I must have missed something here because I could have stopped this.
Because you were his friend and his manager.
Yeah. Yeah. So that absolutely started to come through as well. Throughout kind of those first 2 weeks. I have to say one thing that my own personal work were absolutely, you know, extremely understanding of what was going on. So I am looking in that respect. But it was, I can remember trying to explain it to some people who don't work under my umbrella, who don't work in the same company or same business area. And I don't think at first they really understood the implication of what it was having on me. Because I was just their manager. Mm-hmm. Just the manager. So.
And what I know about you, Miriam, is not only a remarkable woman, you're a remarkable woman with a huge heart for the world. Mm-hmm. And I know you and I have talked before around your team wasn't just your team. You see them like family.
Yeah.
And so anything that's going on in their lives, anything that's hurting them, you feel it too.
Yeah. Definitely. And we'd always been like that, kind of for like the 18 months we'd all work together. We were a little pack. We did have a bit of a pack mentality. So it was really difficult when people were trying to give you advice of what they would do. But that don't mean that's what you're going to do or what you should do. And so I had
what kind of things were people sharing with you?
So it was more, so a little bit that I will just go into, because I think it starts to link the story even more together, is after about 2 weeks of my colleagues passing, there was suddenly news articles that started, because there had been an inquest and some questions were getting asked, which then led to another inquest being done. So there was articles. Now, in the first lot of articles, a lot of people had started to comment things. There was a lot of... no newspaper or no article or no media outlet ever has the full story from start to finish of an 18-month period and everything that goes in that. They use certain words and certain catchphrases and certain ways of terminology of things to make it sound a lot different than what the actual real events were. So there was the initial kind of news article, and what happened was that news article was then copied and pasted by other outlets, and it grew and grew and grew and grew. And next thing I know, it's one of the main kind of tabloids had picked it up. And in this day and age now, with the wonders that is social media, it's no longer people just reading and putting it down and becoming fish and chip wrapping. People can comment. People can give their opinion.
And something that's local all of a sudden becomes national.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love that reminder that you've offered all of us, Miriam. This idea, I think, when we're watching the news or we're reading something, we would often make up that it's truth, that it's facts, that it's real. And actually, what we also know is there'll be a journalist who's had literally minutes to write something, to turn it around, has posted it. And exactly as you say, it will have been edited, reused, repasted. And each time there is a, you know, it gets further and further away from even almost the idea that these are real people. These are human beings. This is a real story. Yeah. And the two may not always correlate.
Yeah, and I think there was a lot of frustrations at that time, but a couple, you know, one of them was we're actually detracting from the fact that the sadness and the overwhelming awfulness, actually, it's someone who chose to take their own life. That they had a family, that they had loved ones who no longer have that person. And people were making very quick snap judgments on a 3-minute read. And I always wonder if the people who made some of the comments that they did about me, if they'd have been stood in front of me or sat in the same room and seeing the person who was at the other side of the phone, reading all those whilst going through everything, not showering, not sleeping, internally blaming themselves anyway, without all this external blame going on, putting pressures on their own relationships because of how they were retracting from the world and starting to lash out at those closest to them. And having a son at an age where he's a teenager, there's GCSEs and things, and we hear the absolute horror stories of what can happen with, we know there's issues with men in general when it comes to suicide, there is also issues with teams and things that are going on there. I had convinced myself not only that I was to blame for my colleague choosing what they chose, that then the whole world also blamed me. So even whilst I was studying ASDA, if someone looked at me, they looked at me because they knew I was that person in that news article. Mm. And they were looking at me going, that's her. Mm. How dare she be in ASDA? And then I'd also convinced myself that Stan and or Mark were about to do something to themselves as well. So I became super hyper aware of any noise, any change in tone, any text message that might, in a normal day-to-day world, it would have been absolutely fine, Mark texting me the way he did and what he did. But I was over and over again in my head. So there was a lot, a heck of a lot going on. And I'm not ashamed to admit, I always think how weird humans can be, that when we're commenting on something saying how sad it is that someone's going to has taken their own life, we then tell someone else within that same comment who's mentioned to also go do the same. Baffling.
There's just a huge irony, and you know, what's the level of violence? Twofold there, you know, exactly as you were saying there, this voice in our heads, the level of self-violence is really palpable as you speak, Miriam, around almost there's one part that you think there's nothing that anybody could say to you that could hurt you any more than you were already hurting yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And yet, there is still this sense of mindlessness of people showing up and still thinking it's okay to be out in the world showing up with these types of comments. And so how did you deal with that, Miriam, then? Was there an element of I'm not going to read this, or because what I'm also hearing is I'm hearing this voice in your head making up stories, people are looking at me, they're of course all made up, and feeling real, right? What do you do? Do you hibernate? What do you do in that space?
So the advice I continually got was, don't read it, stop reading it, stop reading it, stop reading it. And in the end, that made me lash out at those people, because I was very much like, what would you do if you knew you were getting wrote about? And I took it as, if I read all this, at first I couldn't see the wood for the trees, Nick, hence you then entered my life to sort it all out. If I read all this, I'm getting armoured towards it, I'm putting a shield on, no one can say anything more to me that's going to hurt me anymore, because like you said, number one, you're not saying anything that I don't already think and feel naturally. What everybody does when a suicide happens, any single person that's attached to that individual in some way will think and feel that. But it was me putting a big armour up, to protect myself from throw what you want at me moving forward. I think because then I knew there was going to be a follow-up inquest, I was going to need to be there. And I'm a very law-abiding citizen. I've only ever been in court once, that was for jury service. I've never, you know, it's not something, it's totally out of, I never thought I'd just end up in any form of situation like that. It's something that I've literally never prepared myself for.
Almost a masterclass inside a masterclass.
Yeah, definitely. Because you just wouldn't ever put yourself in that situation, would you? So the more I read and the more I armoured myself, but what I was doing whilst I was armouring myself is I was pushing away the people who were actually closest to me.
Yeah, shutting
because
down.
Because my armour against the world included every single person around me.
And also fear, as you said, fear that, what if this happens again?
Yeah.
What else could I be missing?
Yeah.
If I've missed it before, maybe I'll miss it again.
Yeah.
And so may I ask you this? What was Mark's experience of you at that time in your relationship? What did he observe?
So it got to a stage, and I think Mark's masterclass and his kind of wake-up moment was when we were end up sat in the doctor's. Did me and Mark came with me because he had to, because I'd lost the ability to drive and everything. Mark came with me and I sat in that doctor's and I begged the doctor to just give me something that had helped me sleep. Just something. And I started talking
to turn this head off.
Stop me thinking. Yeah. Stop me thinking. I want to numb it all. I don't want to know. And that was Mark's big wake up into, because I broke down in the doctors. I was no longer kind of, it wasn't the angry side. Mark had seen the kind of anger. This was the vulnerable. I'm on the floor now. There's nothing left in the tank. I can't take on. I mean, bear in mind with Mark, bless him, he is a very positive, everything will be fine energy. He's over 6 foot tall. He's loud and is a loud, proud Yorkshireman. Everyone hears him before they see him. So he is very, he's also ex-military. So it's always, you know, everything can be sorted, everything can be fine. And what he learned at that point was, because he would handle it a certain way, doesn't mean I'm going to handle things a certain way. And him continually telling me not to read things, not to listen, not to question, to stop thinking about it. He can do that. He can turn that tap. And I don't know if that is a man and woman thing as well. That off, whereas we go, just turn more. Let me just turn that tap a little bit more. Because the more I think about it, I'm suddenly going to get an epiphany. I'm suddenly going to get this answer. It's going to be in there somewhere. I just have to go through all this stuff.
I think that's so interesting, and it's a constant question. You know, is there some biological, chemical difference between men and women? And certainly, I've spoken about this a lot. There does seem to be some people who can put things, situations, experiences, trauma in a box with a lid on, with a combination lock, you know, firmly on, and just park it on a shelf and feel as if they're able to operate out in the world with that shut. And yet what I do want to say both to you and to anybody else who's either watching or listening to this, is that what we do know is that those very experiences then get in the way of us being able to show up wholehearted. The idea that you, and Brené Brown talks about this, and Danielle and I are both accredited to use her work, this idea that we walk into an arena and we fall flat on our face and we're bloodied and literally broken, that you don't actually get to really be in the world with courage unless you learn how to stand back up. And I think the secret in what you're saying here is when you are flat down in the arena, and of course, when you're in your arena, willing or otherwise, you take other people into their personal arena. So Mark looking at his partner going, oh my goodness, I can't fix her. My tools and techniques aren't working. The secret, you know, part of that being in the arena is when you look up and you look into the seats around the arena, where are you looking? Are you looking at the critics? Are you looking at the cheap seats, you know, the people that just want to give you their stuff? Or are you able to look up into, you know, the seats where you can get help, support, compassion to help you get back on your feet? And so what I really love is the strength that it takes actually for a woman to be able to say, I need help.
Yeah.
I need help here. I know that this is as low as I can afford to go. I need support in getting back up.
Yeah, definitely. We, there'd been a bit of a, not an incident, but something happened where before me and Mark had gone to the doctors, where it's funny how your own mind, when all you're thinking about or all you're reading about or all that's in your mind is about suicide, it is really scary where your own mind will then go. And I can say that I've never thought about doing anything that would ultimately do the most harm to me. But I can remember us driving, and I just thought to myself, if I opened the door of the car and kind of stepped out, would I feel something? Would I feel again? I think I'd armoured myself up that much that I'd just lost all reality. It was, and once I'd kind of spoken to that about Mark, about, you know what, this thought, obviously I didn't act on it, nothing like that, but this thought, isn't it scary that actually this thought even came into my head, that I'd got to the point where I wanted to be numb so much, but then all I craved was to feel.
Yes.
And that were a really weird balance to try and get right as well.
And of course, what we know is, if you numb out the pain, you also numb out the joy.
Yeah.
And so for those people that might think one of their strategies is to put this on one side and never to talk about it and never to do anything with it, the darkness within that is, you don't get, when you armor up and choose to stay in that space, you don't get to choose what comes in. As you're saying, a blanket goes on and that's it. It's like you're just in the world, but almost not.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm getting a sense that getting to the doctors was a turning point.
Yeah, it was. We obviously got some things sorted. I also started going for counselling. And from the doctors, Mark actually got me in the car and took me up to my parents. And we sat, and again, because I don't think a lot of people around me really understood the level of my heart that had gone into my team, my people, and just how broken it had all got. And so, again, that was quite an eye-opener, I think, for my own parents to kind of, Matt did quite a lot of the talking, and kind of said, look, this is super serious. This is, we all really need to, she does good enough taking care of us. We all need to take care of her now. Mm. It's time. I also, from that point, came and had a conversation with, well, a couple of conversations with Stan, about suicide, what it is. He is at an age where he'd already, you know, luckily they are doing things in schools now and stuff like that. So it was more what mum's mind was going on, what was happening in mum's mind. And
big,
just
big conversations.
Yeah, it was to make him feel, I needed to show him it was to when I talk about it, it's okay not to be okay, everyone should talk. I needed to lead by example with that one. I needed to get the bull by the horns and say, right, son, your mum is not doing well at all. These are the reasons why. This is what's happening. I also wanted to protect him from anything that could happen or could come because of these inquests, because of news articles. So in the first one, my name had never been mentioned. I was just a manager. Whereas once we'd been to the inquest, there was more articles, and from that where I was personally named. So you just never knew. I wanted to make sure he was as prepared as possible for any eventuality of what could happen. I mean, strangely enough, on the second lot of articles, the second go around, there wasn't a lot of comments at all. I think because, again, some of the truth had come out. Again, you're taking something that went on for 5 hours and putting it into a 2-minute read with certain words and certain headlines. A lot of it really, really missing, was that literally actually untrue in some of the elements, which was frustrating. But I can remember after we'd come back from the inquest, and I said to Mark, I'm going to have a bath, because that's what we do, don't we? We have a bath.
I put
the kettle on. I need to wash the day off. I need to just... And I heard Mark coming upstairs, and again, that spider sense. And I thought, here we go. There's an article. And he came in and he was like, right, it's there. I was like, right, read it to me. And he read it and I was like, right, okay. And he was like, how are you feeling? Because obviously we'd been through them. And I actually said, anyone can say anything now. That it's all already been said. It's now... I'd got to the point, because that had all happened in kind of the May, had the kind of second inquest and things like that. And I think I'd got to a point there where I had managed to surround myself with so many wonderful, inspirational people, that it certainly didn't take me down again. It made me want to fight for the cause even more. It gave me that kind of right, what more can we do? And it actually channeled me into strength rather than despair. So it kind of proved to me how far I'd come.
And that's such a beautiful moment in the masterclass, which we keep coming back to, this idea that all of a sudden you start to access the power within you. And it sounds quite trite. And let me just explain what I mean by that. Often the masterclass or something that's happening outside of us can feel like power over. So if you think about, you know, people that you didn't even know, having power over how you felt, almost getting even inside your own relationship.
Yeah.
You know, the power over from social media, the news, even the power over you that your mind can has on you about how you feel. And yet something, when you work through the masterclass and go, you know, what can I learn? What can I learn? What you start to tap into then is the power is in within me. And what I love, even as you were sharing that, Miriam, there was a sense of all of a sudden you start to sit up and go, right, okay, I'm now starting to see a new version of me beyond the despair, almost beyond the why, to say, I wouldn't have chosen this, and now I can see another place that I can serve the world. And so could you share a little bit with us, as we start to bring this more to a close, could you share a little bit with us about what your passion is in that space? I know we've spoke a lot, for example, today about suicide. What is your hope in sharing the story?
Oh, my hope is that it will encourage people to talk and just be open and be really honest. There's literally nothing wrong with saying, I've got these thoughts, or something's going on, or I'm struggling, or I'm not okay, or anything like that. Just please, please, please talk. Do not ever once think that your life is not worth something, because everybody is. Also, I think as women, women or men, I think when you're in a position where you lead a team, where you're a manager of people, you are never given a sit-down training course in this is what you do. You shouldn't need to, and hopefully you never have to, and hopefully no one will never need to go through this again. But chances are, unfortunately, in this day and age and with the things that we know are going on in the world, it could certainly be a possibility. So don't think that because you're a manager and a leader, you're going to have it all together if this masterclass comes your way, because you're definitely not. And surround yourself with positive, life-affirming people who will absolutely no doubt get you through it. But yeah, just to say, it's okay if you are feeling that way, and if you know someone who's feeling that way, especially if you're leading someone or managing someone, just be really human about it. And if you're reading anything online, remember there's a whole other side to that story, and the person and people who are in that story are no doubt sat on their phones reading exactly what you're putting, as you put it, because they are obsessing with it. So just maybe think about that. Let's not judge people in a 2-minute article without knowing the full story. Let's only put positivity out there.
And I love what you shared there. Danielle and I often talk about either a wise counsel of people around you that know you and can hold you, or even what we call the heartfelt handful. So five people that you can have in your life where no matter what, depending on what it is that's going on for you, you can reach out and that they've got your back. It just sounds like it's super important. And what, let me ask you this, Miriam, what did you learn about you?
I learned that I am stronger than I know. A very wise lady helped me discover that. I learn that my strength is in my love, is in my compassion and empathy for others. That is literally my strength. It's not the bad thing. That's a really good thing. That I have a right to my story. It's mine. It's mine to share. It's my personal experience with this masterclass. And everybody involved in this masterclass has very, very different ones. We'll have very different opinions and views, but this is mine. That I squeeze my loved ones a little tighter every time. And try and see the light in the world as often as you can. There's too much noise in this day and age going on. Just really strip it back and look at what you've got around you, and definitely choose a really wise counsel, thanks to Nick. And they will no doubt listen to this, but I absolutely have my wise counsel, who for the past 6 months have been absolutely, literally remarkable women, who let me be my unbridled, unashamed self. And we've all just got to do a bit more of that in the world.
And I really want you to know this, Miriam, that, you know, it's been an honour to work with you as close as we have worked, because one of the things we see repeatedly is when women share their stories, we all learn. We all learn. And I think sometimes as women, we forget that actually sharing what's going on for us isn't just about us. It allows others to be able not only to lean in, but to learn. And I love what you said before, you know, we would all love to think we're never going to experience something as tragic as what you've experienced. And yet to tap into our versions of hurt, of grief, of despair, of guilt. What could I have done, should I have done? You know, these are common threads, not just in women, in humanity. So it's such an amazing gift that you've offered every single person that you've shared this with. And I hope that this podcast helps many, 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 many other people just to get to see that life can serve you curveballs, and it's less about that and more about what do we learn? How do we regroup and how do we create a new normal, a wiser woman into the world because of that scenario? Yeah. For sure. So as we close, is there one takeaway that you would like anybody to have from this? And of course there might not be, but if there is there one gem?
You can't stop a masterclass coming. It is going to come. Oh, the universe will make it so somehow. It's going to come your way. You'll kick and scream, cry, get on, you know, be on the floor. But ultimately, that's why it's called a masterclass, because you will come out of the other side. There will be a gem or something within that that you'll find within yourself, that you'll find within someone else. And you'll go, oh, that were it. That were it. That's why. My whole masterclass was designed and set that it meant that I could tell a story that hopefully will help other people, and I will continue my quest of awareness, of prevention, of helping others who have to navigate it. But yeah, they're going to come. So don't try and stop them, and don't think you can, because you can't. They will happen. But there is a gem somewhere in there. There's always a gem.
I can hear so many women internally going, no, I don't want that to be the case. And I love your truth and your honesty about that. So thank you. Honestly, Miriam, it's just been, it's been such a privilege. I've had the tissues with me all the time. I want you to know that Stan hit the jackpot. Absolutely hit the jackpot.
You're going to set me off.
Well, he hit the jackpot when he got you, honey, as his mum. You know, to have a young man coming into the world with this wisdom and a mum who's going to be able to walk him through no matter what his masterclasses are is just incredible. So heart to heart, Miriam, thank you so much for sharing this story with us. For those of you who've been listening to us, again, thank you for your time. We did warn you that it might be a tear jerk. This podcast will be available on www.remarkablewomen.co.uk. We're also on iTunes and Spotify. But for now, Miriam, thank you once again. And we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you, Nick.
Bye-bye.
Bye.